This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Joan Singler and Betty Lou Valentine, who were both members of the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, during the 1960s. Joan was a founding member of Seattle CORE, and Betty Lou, a national board member of the NAACP, joined Seattle CORE in 1964. Joan Singler and Betty Lou Valentine are here today to tell us about the book they co-authored with Jean Durning and Maid Adams, titled Seattle in Black and White, The Congress of Racial Equality and the Fight for Equal Opportunity. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we focus on the Seattle chapter of CORE, would you begin by saying a few words about the national organization, its philosophy and purpose?
National CORE actually grew out of another movement, Fellowship of Reconciliation, and it started in Chicago in the 40s. James Farmer and a number of other people were active in that organization and had actually tried something called the Freedom Ride at that time, and the whole project just kind of fizzled out. And then CORE became active in New York. That was the headquarters of National CORE. And the very big sort of attention-getting project was the Freedom Rides in 1961. And James Farmer, Congressman John Lewis, Albert Bigelow, a number of people who were also part of other organizations joined together to start the Freedom Rides to challenge interstate bus and train and plane waiting areas that were supposed to be integrated but still were carrying signs that said colored only, white only.
What led you or prompted you to write Seattle in Black and White, your book about the Seattle chapter of CORE?
A number of things. I think one of them was our realization that this was a period of time that was fast passing. Among other things, some number of our leading members had recently died, and at their memorial services, other people were telling our story. So we decided to kind of put it all together as we remembered it and as we had lived it.
I would say, in addition to that, there were a number of things written by other people in Seattle about this period who were not involved and actually was giving out misinformation. And we wanted to correct that misinformation. I would say up until Dr. Quintard Taylor published his book, to me that was the first time I had read anything that was really accurate about what was happening with CORE, with that organization and the projects and our attempt to end discrimination in Seattle.
Before we go into more detail, would you give just a very brief overview of the book?
Well, we attempted to explain the philosophy behind CORE, which is direct action based on nonviolent passive resistance. In other words, confronting people with the fact that they discriminate, but by our presence, saying that, being there, picketing, organizing boycotts, trying to get the message across that something had to change. So we attacked, probably not a good word, but we did.
We worked in three basic areas. We were concerned particularly with employment for Negroes in the 60s. We were very concerned with school integration issues, and we were also very concerned with employment, schools.
Police,
what am I leaving out?
Police brutality.
Police brutality.
Housing, I guess.
And housing. So the book is kind of organized in that fashion. One can read about employment activities and then housing activities, etc.
In your book, you say that in the early 60s, Seattle was effectively a segregated town. Would you explain?
I happened to come to Seattle in the fall of 1959 to go to the graduate school at the UW, and it was very clear to me that there were two worlds here. If you were white, you could live in almost any area of the city. The people that you interacted with were all white, clerks, taxi drivers, bus drivers, just anyone in your world, and you needed not have any association whatsoever with Negroes. Negro people in that period were pretty much limited to a small central section of Seattle, worked at odd jobs, were not in any sense integrated into the society. And all of this was done rather passively, rather benightedly, and there were no signs that said colored only, but it was fairly clear to most people that there were two worlds coexisting.
Right. I think the CEOs, heads of stores, businesses, assumed that customers would not want to interact, would not transact business with stores if there were Negro sales clerks. And that was some of the reasoning they gave us when we interviewed these people and said, why don't you have any Negroes working in your store? And there were a number of reasons, but it became very clear that they were afraid that if they had a Negro employee, people would not patronize their store. As a matter of fact, the CEO of Far West Cab said people just won't get in the cab if there's a Negro driver, and he refused to hire Negroes.
What triggered the formation of the Seattle chapter of CORE?
That was the Freedom Rides. In May of 1961, the Freedom Rides, the first two buses that left Washington, D.C., were set upon by mobs, one in Anniston, where the bus was burned, and another one in Montgomery, Alabama, where the law enforcement people stood aside while a mob physically beat the Freedom Riders. And James Farmer, the head of CORE, went on national TV and said, you know, this cannot stand. I invite the populace of this country that cares about democracy to join us. And as a result of that, about 400 people joined, and one of them happened to be from Seattle. And at a chance meeting with this young man, 19-year-old white art student, myself, my husband, and two other people decided that we would help him become a Freedom Rider. And while we were contacting groups and raising money to send this young man to the South, we realized that the same problems that people faced in the South, we were facing here, only on a more polite basis. And so that was a catalyst for us to form the Seattle chapter.
Who was drawn to join the Seattle chapter of CORE, and what were their motivations?
Oh, a multitude of people. Some were people who had been on the political scene before this. Some people came through their churches. There was a strong moral element to joining. Some were just people who needed jobs, who needed housing, who were aware and were living with the discrimination.
The churches played a very big role, I think, in swelling our numbers. The Unitarian Church was one, the Catholic St. James, the Archdiocese was very supportive. All of the black churches joined with CORE and the NAACP and any of the projects that we pulled together to try to do something about discrimination.
We also had some support from the Jewish community.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Joan Singler and Betty Lou Valentine, co-authors with Jean Durning and Maid Adams of the book Seattle in Black and White, The Congress of Racial Equality and the Fight for Equal Opportunity. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How many members did you have at the beginning?
Well, originally there were just five of us, but we called a meeting at the YWCA, and about 20 to 30 people showed up. And with that core of people, we organized the first project in employment, which was trying to get people hired at Safeway stores, because there were two Safeway stores in the central area, and they had so few Negro employees that we went to them and said, you need to hire more. And so because of that, and because of the picket line that we established, it was very visible to people in the community, and so our numbers increased very, very fast.
We have listed in the book, by the way, all of the people whom we, at this point in time, recognize as having been members of CORE or have been supporters of CORE, and we felt that they needed to be recognized.
that was another reason for writing the book, was every year when Black History Month rolls around, it seems that the same people that have been asked about Martin Luther King or the Civil Rights Movement are interviewed. And there are hundreds of people who were active for a good 6 years every day of the week trying to do something about discrimination in Seattle, and they're never recognized. So in the book, we tried to name a lot of people and what they did in CORE activities.
Would you speak a bit about CORE's rules for action?
Well, we attempted to put a very good middle-class face on our demonstrations. And so we had training sessions and orientation session before you could become a member of CORE. So we had these training sessions on nonviolence and passive resistance, and people had to agree to that behavior if they were involved in a demonstration. But I'll let Betty Lou speak to our dress code.
In fact, we were saying to the general public, we're just like you, let us in. And one of the ways of doing that was we were terribly respectable. Women wore skirts and dresses, no slacks. Men wore hats, white shirts, ties, suits. We look now back at pictures from that period and realize that we were quite different than we are today. I think today is, of course, much freer and easier. And I have the feeling that it was too bad that we, in fact, took that position. Because basically we said, we're just like you, but we want to change you. So there was a little conflict there.
Why did you decide to first focus on supermarkets as a place to end discrimination?
Oh, I get to tell my joke here. I always wanted to say, you know, we didn't protest against Boeing because we didn't buy airplanes. We bought milk and meat and, you know, food on a daily basis. And as Joan said earlier, some of these stores were located in the central area and had a clientele that was largely made up of Negroes. So we had the potential for bringing
economic pressure,
right, on the supermarkets.
Would you like to say more about your Don't Shop Where You Can't Work campaign?
Well, we were trying to alert the Black community to what our plan was. And so we put signs in store windows that said, don't shop where you can't work. And the other sign said, don't cross the Freedom Line. We never called it a boycott. We called it a Freedom Line. But in conjunction with that, we put a leaflet at every door in that four-track central area. And on that leaflet, besides telling people, you know, that we were planning this, we also had a coupon on there for people who were looking for a job and recruited people. Actually, we ran through the test that was given to people applying for jobs at supermarkets so that we knew that there were lots of people who were actually qualified. So when we went to Safeway and said, you know, it's time to change your policy, and they said there are no qualified people, we knew there were qualified people, and we sent them all to apply for a job.
Right. And we worked, I might mention here, with both the NAACP and the Urban League so that we knew there were people in both of those groups as well who were looking for work or housing and were indeed qualified. Do I remember, Joan, that we had a business major who did some training?
Yes. Actually, the vice president of CORE, Wallace Johnson, who was getting his degree in business administration, organized these people who were looking for employment and kind of ran them through a little mock interview of what they could expect if they went to apply for a job. So we knew that, one, they would appear dressed the way Safeway might expect them to be dressed, that they knew the answers, that they could do the math test because there was no barcodes at that time. So they had to know if you bought something 3 for $89 and you only bought one, how much do you charge? So, yeah, Wallace ran that program.
How successful were your efforts to end discrimination in employment in Seattle supermarkets?
They varied. One of our examples is the Safeway store that Joan mentioned earlier, and that one went very well, very quickly. We also worked with the A&P, which is no longer in the Seattle area, which did not go well, and actually took years to get them to hire people in all 15 of their stores. And then some of the supermarkets, we actually did not get around to putting up a Freedom line, but they saw how things were moving. Mm-hmm. Joan, do you remember some Tradewell?
Tradewell, and then Lucky's. We had been negotiating with Lucky Store for months and months. So we gathered people in front of the store, and the manager came out and said, wait, it's time to talk. Same thing with Frederick and Nelson's. They saw the demonstration walking past their store in the direction of the Bon Marché. And it was that kind of message by just numbers of people where we didn't really have to initiate a boycott. A change occurred as a result of our impact on other businesses.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Joan Singler and Betty Lou Valentine, co-authors with Jean Durning and Maid Adams of the book Seattle in Black and White, The Congress of Racial Equality and the Fight for Equal Opportunity. You alluded a bit to this earlier, but what were the reasons that employers gave for not hiring African Americans?
The biggest one was that there were no qualified people. The Bond said that. Nordstrom's was worried about hiring shoe salesmen. They didn't think women wanted a black male trying shoes on. Frederick and Nelson's said they would agree to hire sales clerk, but not the elevator operators, because they said these girls are the face of our business. And so they wanted a particular type of person, and that person didn't include any black women. But I think the majority of excuse was that there just were no qualified people.
Let's move on now to discrimination in housing. What were the housing opportunities for blacks in Seattle in the 1960s?
Well, the fact that a majority of black people lived in 4 census tracts and continued as the black population increased, it just became more dense. It wasn't that there were more people, so they moved out. It just became a denser population. And the real estate industry, both apartment house operators and realtors, sometimes were very blatant and open about the fact that they absolutely would not sell or rent to a Negro. One of our chairmen, Tim Martin, was married to a white woman and called a realtor and asked her what exchange she was calling from. It was EA in that time, East. He said, is someone that you're interested in buying a house for a Negro? And she said, yes, it was her husband. He said, we don't sell to Negroes.
And these were court enforced, by the way. There were covenants in the leases that said you could not rent or lease or otherwise sell a house to people. And they specified not only Negroes, but often Jewish people and Asian people. And the courts enforced these covenants. So discrimination was official.
One of the rules for a core action is that you must investigate. And so I chaired the housing committee for a while, and it seemed to me it was so blatant. Why would we have to investigate? But we did anyway, and we sent out tests. Starting in May of 1963 through August of that year, and we sent couples, black couples and white couples, both with about the same income, looking for the same price house. And the black couple would go in, and sometimes the realtor wouldn't show up, or if he saw the black couple coming, sometimes they would lock the door. But if they actually got through the door and talked to the realtor, whatever house they were interested in was either sold, or the price went up, or the down payment went up. The white couple would follow up and get absolutely the opposite treatment. If you're not interested in that house, we have another house to show you. And so we documented that. We went to a number of realtors and apartment houses, sent out all of that documentation, and nothing was ever done with it. And so that's when we started a project with Sit-In's real estate office.
Would you like to say a few words about that project and how it turned out?
It had a mixed reaction, actually, and there were several stages to it. One involved the testing that Joan has just described. Another involved an attempt to shop at open houses. And that one brought us actually some national attention. Joan, you were a part of that.
It was called Operation Window Shop, and we encouraged members of the Black community on a given weekend to simply go out and look at open houses in the suburbs. And we had put a leaflet out and we were announcing it in the churches and so forth. Well, the reaction from the real estate industry was to actually shut down. They pulled about 85% of all of their ads from the newspapers, and any open housing signs were taken down and realtors closed their office. And as chair of that project, I received a phone call from a realtor on Mercer Island and one out in Lake City that said, you know, we would have preferred to keep our office open, but we were told by the real estate industry to close down because of pulling all of the ads from the newspaper and shutting down the real estate office. Somehow or other, that got on the AP line, and Chet Huntley called my house and said, tell me what's going on in Seattle.
So how did your efforts to end discrimination in housing turn out ultimately?
Well, I think that in order to tell you about that, we need to mention that there were many other groups working on this project, including one that actually secured and or built houses that were specifically to be sold to Black people. There was
Fair Housing Listing Service.
And with the efforts of these various groups, including CORE, of course, we were able to secure a number of places, including some where there was actually cross-burning.
Are you talking about Marion West?
Yes.
Yes, well, interracial couples really had it tough. And yeah, there was a cross-burning on her property. But also the chairman of CORE at the time, Tim Martin, tried to purchase a house over in Lake Hills, and the buyer didn't let anyone in the neighborhood know about this, and Tim had to go there in the evening when it became dark with cash for the down payment on the house before the man changed his mind. So there was that kind of activity. But Tim's wife became involved in this Fair Housing Listing Service. And it was the Unitarian Church in the north end of Seattle, the Unitarian Church on the east side, Sid Gerber, just an individual who had started the State Board Against Discrimination, and other groups like that, that just knocked on doors and said to people, would you sell your house to anybody? And they got quite a few people who said, yes, of course we will. So they had quite a list of homes that they were able to sell.
It's somewhat ironic now that the area, those four census tracts where people were limited to in the 60s, are now, of course, very ideal. They're close to the city, and the community has totally changed. It is no longer a minority community.
Right. The street that I lived on currently and moved in 1963, we were the only white family on the block. There was one Asian and the rest was all Black families. And now there's one Black family and all the rest of people on our block are white. Totally reversed.
What do you see as the key accomplishments of CORE, looking at all the work that you did in the 1960s?
Well, certainly employment. I think we opened up employment, not only supermarkets and the department stores, but we were able to get people into jobs working as truck drivers, delivering milk, the bread companies. We actually went to Washington Natural Gas. So I think employment was probably our biggest success because we not only got people employed, but we opened up areas. The cab companies finally had to start hiring Blacks.
And more abstractly, I think that what we did was to make Seattle people aware that there were indeed issues. Mm-hmm. I think that Seattle people either didn't think about it, or if they thought about it, That was just the way the world was. They didn't think of it as discrimination. So making people aware that there were issues was one of the main things that CORE did. Obviously, we didn't solve the school issue, still an issue.
Police brutality is still an issue.
Yeah.
I think housing also, between our focusing, highlighting the fact that the real estate industry was discriminating and the Fair Housing Listing Service actually proved to realtors that they could have this business if they wanted to, and it started to change about 1965. Some of the realtors said, I think I'd like to get in on that business.
Based on what you learned from your work with the Congress of Racial Equality, what advice do you have for people today trying to bring about positive change in society?
Well, I think anybody can do it if they find a couple of like-minded people. Yesterday, I went on the web to look at other things that were going on that might be community-based. And around the country, there are a number of just moms and dads who have organized themselves to put pressure on school districts to try to improve just the quality of schools. And I was amazed at how many organizations there are out there. So I think it just takes somebody who's willing to commit some time, turn off your computer, walk away from the TV, and become active.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Certainly, I think people need to be aware. They need to think about what is happening around them and with them and not just accept the world as it is because that's what it is. I think that that kind of awareness is what then leads to the kind of action that Joan just talked about. And I would suggest that everyone actually on a daily basis think about what is happening. I have a neighbor who just left 3 days at the University of Washington Hospital and who said to me, I didn't see a single African American in those 3 days on staff. And that kind of perception of things is what is needed so that we don't just accept what is.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Joan Singler and Betty Lou Valentine, co-authors with Jean Durning and Maid Adams of the book Seattle in Black and White, The Congress of Racial Equality and the Fight for Equal Opportunity, published in 2011 by the University of Washington Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.